Welcome to Health Tech Matters, a podcast where we talk to healthcare startup founders, product managers, and designers, and discuss current trends in building great healthcare products. I'm your host, Mary, and today we're going to talk about diabetes treatment, behavioral design, and mental health. Our guest is Napala Pratini, co-founder of Habitual, type 2 diabetes prevention and reversal startup based in the UK. Stay tuned! How did you meet your partner? Because you are not a doctor, so you might not have this connection on university level.
Sure. So I did my MBA at Oxford a couple of years ago. My co-founder, Ian, happened to also do his MBA, but it was at INSEAD. During that same time, we then both came back to London and happened to get hired by a small research company that was doing research into type 2 diabetes reversal, which is the space that we're now in. So it was a fortuitous thing that we both got hired by this company. We got really close to the research and saw how life-changing these interventions could be for people's lives and decided that we wanted to do it in a much bigger way. So left to start Habitual.
So your focus is on business administration, correct?
Well, I mean, an MBA is a generic business.
Yeah,
Little startups, little finance, little strategy type thing. I studied biochemistry, actually, and I did cancer research for a while. And then I went to work in startups for a number of years. So I did growth and marketing plus or minus here and there, and did that for about 7 years and then did my MBA. So generally growth for early stage companies is my professional background. And then on top of that, whatever skills you can claim to get from a business degree.
So you decided to start Habitual with your partner as a side hustle, or you just quit and decided, okay, next day I'll be working on Habitual full time?
So it's a good question, because I think it's that, especially for a first-time founder, that's the really scary thing, is to just say, okay, quit my job and give it a go. So I think we were really lucky, both of us, in that we had other work that we were doing at the same time. And there was never that moment of like, we need to do this really scary thing and tomorrow we're going to be 100%, because we could take it day by day. So I was doing some marketing consulting work on the side. Ian was working in the hospital. And we basically kept pushing ourselves to have a fundraising conversation, put together a deck, talk about product, like take all the steps that we would be taking anyway. But basically, as we got more and more traction from investors, from customers, et cetera, we were able to taper down the rest of what we were doing, which I think made it a lot easier than saying, right, I make money in this high paying job and tomorrow I'm not going to. That's a really tough decision to make.
That's very true. Sometimes people are saving for years just to start working on it, join accelerator probably, and they're just into it for 24/7 days a week and just trying to make it as big as possible, as fast as possible. So that's just a different way of doing things.
I think for us, we were able to raise money pretty quickly. So we started really we incorporated September 2019, and we raised an angel round, which closed in December. So within a couple of months. And at that point, I was able to say, like, okay, we can pay ourselves something. I don't have to continue having other work. And we started hiring people. So once you can do that, it really becomes a full-time thing. I think often, though, fundraising doesn't happen that quickly.
I think it can help a first-time founder to raise money working on healthcare startup.
So I guess I can tell you our story and what worked out for us, and we can take what we will from that. So my co-founder had actually done an internship with a company called Echo Pharmacy. So it's a digital pharmacy here in the UK. And it just so happens that they had sold earlier that year to Lloyds Pharmacy, which is owned by McKesson. So the founders of that business had exited and had some money and started angel investing. So he was actually the one that ended up being the first domino to fall in our angel round. And then he brought in a bunch of his friends and early Echo investors. And I guess the lesson there is that actually when Ian went to him, it wasn't with a fundraising pitch. He didn't know that he was angel investing at that point. It was for advice, because he knew the health tech space. He knew other investors. He had done the early stage thing before. And then Stephen, who's the Echo founder, was like, well, I've started investing now. This could be interesting for me. So especially as a first-time founder, like there are so many people out there with so many different experiences and pieces of advice to give you. So it doesn't hurt to seek that out, and you never know what's going to come of it. So people like Stephen, for example, who have done the same journey in the last couple of years and really understand the space, even if they don't end up investing, they probably have a lot that you could learn from.
That's a very interesting piece of advice. So why did you actually decide to work on this problem first?
Well, so like I said, Ian and I met working for this research company that was researching diabetes reversal. And just to take a step back and explain a bit more about that, up until recently, we as modern medical systems thought of type 2 diabetes as a long-term chronic irreversible condition. So if you went to the doctor and you were diagnosed with diabetes type 2, they would probably prescribe you a pill and say, maybe eat less, exercise more, take your pills. Over time, you would probably get given more pills. Your blood sugar would get more out of control, maybe insulin. So 50% of patients with type 2 diabetes get put on insulin eventually. And actually, what this research in the last 10 years is showing is that you can reverse type 2 diabetes completely. So no more medications, no insulin, and natural blood sugar control. You can reverse that by helping people lose weight and sustain that weight loss and create better, healthier habits around food and exercise. So that is what the company was doing that we were working for. And we saw firsthand really how this changed people's lives. So we would speak to patients who'd been type 2 diabetic for a couple of years, had been on medications, were worried about stroke and limb amputation and worried that they wouldn't see their grandkids grow up, and then completely reversed it. And for every person, that looks different. Their goals and motivations, and then what they can do after they reverse it is something different for everybody, but really amazing outcomes across the board. So we saw that and we were like, okay, well, first of all, this is amazing. We, for so many years, have just thrown pills and injections at the problem. But on the other hand, what we realized when we looked at the numbers was that the way that they were delivering these programs to people was just super unscalable. So there was no way of, with the way that they were doing it in the trials, there was no way of reaching all of the people in need of this intervention. So if you look at the numbers in the UK alone, it's about 4 million people with type 2 diabetes. If you look at the number of dietitians, for example, they're outnumbered like, I don't know, 2000 to one. I don't remember the exact numbers, but we were trying to put together a business model, which was this one-to-one coaching. And the reason that we stumbled upon this is that we were trying to figure out how many dietitians you would need to hire. And then we were like, okay, there's not actually enough dietitians in the country to serve all the people who need it, right? So we started thinking, technology has done so many things in health. How can we apply what we know about what works in this face-to-face interaction and put that into a digital experience and therefore give it to the many, many more people who need it who wouldn't otherwise be able to access it?
Do you have anybody who has type 2 diabetes?
Oh, personally. It's an interesting one because so many founders have these kind of personal stories. So they're solving a problem they have personally or somebody in their family. I am very lucky to not have anybody in my immediate friends or family with type 2 diabetes. Ian is the same, but has obviously saw many, many patients over many years. And he specialized in emergency medicine. So he would see the worst of diabetes.
How did you come up with this product? Was this diet? Because it's very special.
Our product is really two things. So it's Total Diet Replacement, which is a food product. It's nutritionally complete, low calorie shakes, soups, and porridge. And that is the product that was used in these diabetes reversal trials that I mentioned. And there's a couple other off-the-shelf providers that have been around for a number of years. So that in itself is not new. It's like the BBC writes about the shakes and soup diet. It's been in the public space for a while, but traditionally thought of as a crash diet. So something that they talk about yo-yo diet. So you do this crash diet, you do 800 calories a day, you lose a ton of weight, and then you go back to your old eating habits. And of course, you just put all the weight back on and then you go up and down. And the business models of those companies are basically based around somebody crashing down in weight, crashing back up, and then coming back to them and doing it for a second, a third, a fourth time. So that is the tool that we use to help people lose a significant amount of weight. And the second piece of what we do is digital therapeutics and behavior change. So what was done in the research trials was they combined total diet replacements. They used this tool that they knew was super effective at helping people lose weight. They combined it with a behavior change program. When I was talking about using dietitians, what they did in the trial was they had a dietitian meet once every couple of weeks with the patient, and they took them through this structured behavior change program. Everything from meal planning to developing an exercise routine to mental habits around food. So that is the piece that my co-founder and I said, why can't we digitize this and put this behavior change program in a digital format and deliver it to somebody, regardless of where they live, what time of day it is, et cetera. So that is really, I think, where we see the innovation in helping somebody to change their behaviors without needing a human on the other end of the phone or the Zoom call these days, and being able to deliver it to them in a way that works for their life and their lifestyle and really is customizable to their needs. Helping somebody to actually change what they've been doing for decades in many cases, and doing that on a sustainable basis. So not just doing a shakes and soups diet for a few weeks, but using that to make a change in the rest of their habits. You have to make sure you're building something that they want to engage with. But on the other hand, you need to have that vision for them, because they're not going to tell you what the next thing is that they want. But when it works for them, it's really going to work. So I think it's something we constantly think about internally as we do product design sprints and think about how we build going forward. It's about building on what works and doing lots of user testing and being super iterative, but at the same time, like, really painting a vision for what the future could hold. And then I guess working backwards from there and making sure that at every step of the way, as you get there, you're building something that somebody really wants to engage with. That's, I guess, the origin of what we do.
You mentioned behavioral change. So how do you keep people motivated? I know that you have accountability and teammates in the program.
Motivation is such a complicated topic, and it's so different for everybody. I guess I would say that our approach is very multi-pronged, because we know that something different works for everybody. So there is the teammate aspect. So we put people into groups and they go through the program with groups over the 6 months. For some people, that is what keeps them going. So we've had patients in the past that say, actually, habitual team, we don't want to hear from you. I want to be supported by people who are going through the same thing as me. And that is what keeps them motivated and incentivized. In some cases, it's really an internal thing. So a lot of the work we do through for our behavior change program for the first 3 months, so it's a 6 month long program. The first 3 months is when they do the total diet replacement diet. Most of the work that we do there is around mental habits, around food, and around health behaviors, if you will. So we spend a lot of time building positivity, because a lot of people who struggle with eating have these negative mental cycles in which they crave something, they eat way more than they want to, then they tell themselves you're weak and useless, and then they eat more, and it's this negative cycle, right? So we do a lot around of positivity. We do a lot around reframing lapses and relapses, we call them. So again, often what will happen for people who struggle with eating is that they'll eat really well and really healthily for a certain period of time. They'll stick to some diet or whatever strategy it is for, call it a week, a month, whatever it is. And then they'll have a bad day and they'll eat something they didn't mean to. And then everything just spins out of control. And they think, I've done this one bad thing. Again, I'm not strong enough to do this. I'm useless. I'll never be this person I want to be. And then everything again goes out the window. So we do a lot around reframing that and saying, look, everybody has a bad day. Everybody gets angry sometimes. Everybody needs that biscuit or that piece of pizza or whatever it is. And really, the important thing isn't that you can't ever have it. The important thing is actually that you can have it, and then you can go back to your healthy habits, right? So there's tons of different work we do around the various different pieces of behavior change. For some people, actually, they don't have a problem with lapses and relapses. It's not a cravings thing. It's about social support, for example. So we do a bit of everything. So to hopefully capture everybody who comes to us and really give them something that works for them. There are really specific ways of tracking whether you're healthy. So there's like step counting, there's calorie counting, there's macronutrient counting, there's blood glucose measures. There's all these like one-off things. And people tend to get obsessed with these. And then all of a sudden they're like, well, this isn't a measure of my whole health. And then they let it go. And actually for us, it's all about the trajectory. So you have a bad day, that's fine. But if the overall trend is going in the right direction, that's what matters, right? So we talk about, we're called habitual, and we talk a lot about habits and habit building. We talk about nutritional habits. We talk about physical habits. So that's like exercise, but that's also sleep. That's posture, breathing, et cetera. And then we talk about mental habits, obviously. So in those three categories, we ask our users every day, how did you do? How are your physical habits? How are your mental habits? How are your nutritional habits? And what that does is that reframes the way that somebody thinks about something. Because if you go for a whole day and then you have like one cookie after dinner, but you've done a really good job otherwise with your nutrition, then you still, you know, maybe you're not 100% on nutritional habits, but you're still like at 75%, right? So all of that hard work counts for something. Whereas if they're not thinking about it in that way, then often it's like, oh gosh, I slipped up and I had that cookie. Why don't I just eat the rest of the package now? Because all my hard work is out the window. So, I mean, I think being kind to ourselves, regardless of whether or not we're trying to lose weight or improve our health or whatever it is these days, is super important. Because also when we're stuck inside and on our computers all day, it's really hard to be really critical of ourselves, whether that's eating or exercising or how we're working. So I think we could all use a little bit of that.
And how do you make people believe that they can make this change? Because we all can make a mistake. We all can forget about our health for a day or two. Mm. And after that, let's say you have this tip that, okay, you made a mistake. You can come back and it will be fine. You're making progress. But let's say a person normally loses belief mm-hmm. in themselves. Because they made this mistake and they are still having this perception of yourself as a perfect person, so they cannot make any mistakes. So how do you give them back this belief?
So. Well, it's a number of things. And I guess what I would say is it's something that needs to build over time, right? So you can't just give somebody a lesson or an exercise to do, and then all of a sudden they have this confidence and they'll be, that will take them through the rest of their life. And they will believe forever that they can do something. What I will say is we do a lot of this in the beginning of the program. So like I mentioned with the positivity, the work around that. We do, the very first thing that people do with us is called a purpose letter, in which they think about what are the various reasons that they're making this change. And actually, if you look at a lot of these kind of behavior change experts in the space, what they do with their patients or clients is that they spend all this time when somebody is super motivated. So in the beginning of a program, so when you're like, I'm going to change my life, it is day one and I'm ready to do this. They use that as a time to build up this bank of positivity, of motivation, of the reasons that you want to change, and build up all those confidence, like write it down on paper, literally keep a journal of all of these things, so that when in 4 months something gets really hard, you can look back on that and be reminded. Because what happens really is that we have ups and downs, right? Everybody always does. And you need to capture that up with those feelings around that moment. So that when you're at the bottom, you don't say, you don't forget about all of those good things, right? So you can look back on that and remind yourself of why you're doing this, of all the amazing things that you have done in the past, et cetera. The other thing I'll say on that is that we also do a lot of work around helping people prove to themselves that they can do things on even a very, very small scale. So I think often confidence comes in large part from proving to yourself that you can do something, right? So as people, just one example of this, as people end total diet replacement, so they do 3 months on the shakes and soups diet, and then they graduate back onto normal food. As they end those first 3 months, we do something called testing yourself on purpose. So over 3 months, people get really good at avoiding cravings. They've thrown out all the biscuits in their house, whatever it is that their vice, they've gotten really good at it. And they're doing these 4 shakes, soups, porridges a day, pretty systematically, usually. So because they're comfortable in that, they're in a place that they can like test themselves on purpose, essentially. So we'll say, buy that package of Oreos that you, if you were in day one of the program, you would not have been able to resist, right? Or go out to the pub with friends and don't have a pint, but enjoy yourself. Do what is going to test you on a really small scale. So not something that you can't resist, but do something really small. Try not to engage in that behavior, and then prove to yourself that you can do it, right? And so that's as much about building resilience as it is proving to yourself, like doing it and then realizing, oh, I actually am strong enough to do that, which then builds your confidence. So it's this virtuous cycle.
So people right now are very interested in these programs, like all these books, Tiny Habits, Atomic Habits,
yeah.
And they're all talking about the same thing, step-by-step habits. So you are starting with a small step, let's say flossing one tooth, and then you are doing two, three, and in a month you are doing the whole mouth.
Yeah.
So it's just making these tiny, tiny, tiny steps. And then when you're building this routine, you're feeling fine because you've already done so many actions that you're getting used to these activities, even if you do not really like them.
If you look at the habit science, so we worked with this really amazing behavior change psychologist, and she'd done a ton of research on the whole body of literature behind habit science. And a habit is essentially a brain pathway. So a habit is an activity that happens automatically without you thinking about it, more or less. And the reason that that happens is because there's a neural pathway in your brain that is, for example, brushing your teeth is a good example. When you were super young and had never done it, brushing your teeth was like the weirdest thing in the world, right? None of us probably remember it, but you have to teach yourself to do it. And now I can scroll through my email on my phone while I'm brushing my teeth because I don't have to spend brain space on it. So the process of developing a habit is really the process of creating that neural pathway. So the reason that you would do something stepwise like that is because you can then build that pathway over time, essentially. So I do think that they call it, I guess, sometimes habit stacking, which is combining one thing you're in a habit of with another thing that you want to add on. So I want to meditate every day. Okay, why don't I meditate just before I have my coffee? I'm already in the habit of having my coffee, for example. Or like you say, stacking on top of each other. So maybe you want to eventually become a runner. Okay, you're not going to go run a marathon today, but how about you run around the block tomorrow and then increase from there? So there's definitely validity in that. I think often what is missing in the habit change, habit building advice is that actually it's not building the habit so much that is hard, but it's breaking the habits that you don't want, right? So I guess they often say, you'll hear it takes whatever 26 days or however long it takes to build a habit, right? But Celia, the behavior change psychologist that we worked with, what she would say is that building that habit is super easy. 26 days is like nothing, right? But you, in order to build that habit, you probably have to break another habit that you've been doing for 2, 5, 10 years. And you can't just do that overnight. So that's actually the really hard part. It's not building the new habit into your routine. It's breaking that old habit. And that is what takes not just 26 days, but often much, much longer than that. So that's not to say that those two things can't happen simultaneously, but I think often that's what's missing when you think about habit building and you get stuck in this like, okay, I'm drinking more water and brushing my teeth more and these like minuscule habits. But when it's really about like changing your health, you have to think really holistically about my exercise habits, my nutritional habits, et cetera. And those things all have probably bad or not as good habits that you're already engaging with. So that's what I think makes it really tricky.
Do you think that designing the environment against your own habits, for example, you are designing kitchens, there is no space for junk food. Let's say you have your fridge only for veggies, and there is even no shelf for Oreo, for cookies, and it's designed in a way that you will have to spend more time, more resources to create something that will be against your health.
I mean, that we talk about that with our patients a lot. If you look at all of these habit building, changing books. They say, put your running shoes by the door or take away the cookies, whatever. External triggers play a huge role in the behaviors that we engage in. So there's obviously the internal motivation and the internal drive we have to do something. But if our external environment is working against us, it's that much harder to do. So that's not to, or if you put your running shoes by the door, you'll always go running. So I guess it's not a surefire way, but it is a really important part of nudging yourself towards the right behaviors. And that designing your environment doesn't have to mean remodeling your kitchen, for example. It can be really small things. Like we talk about, for example, if you're at work and you always, like, whenever somebody brings in cookies to work, that's your pitfall. So how do you plan advance for that, right? If somebody's bringing in cookies, why don't you bring in a healthy snack to have alongside? Or maybe you partner with a colleague to go on a walk when the cookies come in, whatever that is, right? But it's all about creating the environment that's going to set you up for success. And that doesn't have to be a huge thing a lot of the time. It's really small changes often.
And talking about this external environment, sometimes it's not just one-time stress when somebody comes with pizza or with cookies and you can survive. Because it's just one time per week, you can just walk away. Sometimes you are living with a partner, with your family, and they're not really eating very healthy. So what would you recommend to people who have to deal with this situation?
It's a really tough one. And we do see it. A lot of our patients have families who that have to cook for example. And even if it's not super unhealthy, when you're on total diet replacement, you can't have other foods. And they'll tell us that's really hard. Actually, when I'm cooking for my daughters, I just want to eat a bowl of rice or whatever I'm cooking for them. So I think it's definitely complicates things. It exacerbates it if their habits are on the opposite side of the spectrum, so quite bad. I think that external environment and friends and family play such a role in eating habits and exercise, really everything. And it's about trying to surround yourself with people who can support you in that journey towards better health. And obviously that's harder sometimes than others, but I think it's really important for everybody who's undergoing this change to help people understand that, one, it's not just a phase. For a lot of people, they will have tried different diets, different exercise programs, whatever in the past, and they haven't stuck to them or they've fallen off track for various reasons. And I think, therefore, friends and family can sometimes get a bit disenchanted, or they'll be like, oh, it's just another phase. And we have patients that tell us that their friends were like, you look great, but it's not going to last, right? Not meaning to be mean, but just trying to be realistic. So I think it's about helping them to understand that this is a new person that you're becoming. And then secondly, that it's not just about losing weight. It's not just about aesthetics. It's about being healthier in the long term. And that's good for everybody, right? Because at the end of the day, it means you'll live longer, happier, healthier. And of course, your friends and family should want that. So really helping them get on board, I think, is super important and a tough thing to do, but a really important part of health change journey.
I totally agree. And I think it's very good that in Habitual, you have 6 months program. So it's just enough time to build some good mental health habit, as well as some nutritional habits. This might be enough to get some friends who will support you, even if your family does not. Enough recommendations and overall information about how this will make you more healthy, happier. So how do you think weight loss and healthy habits programs that will change in the future?
So I guess I can tell you where I'd like to see things go, where I hope these programs go. I think for us, the way that we think about our program and the outcomes, it's all about driving people towards better health, and weight loss is the tool that we know helps people get there. But it's not weight loss for the sake of it. It's weight loss for the sake of helping people achieve better health outcomes. So at the end of the day, that's where we want to help all of us shift our mentality. And I think if you look at healthcare systems, there's much more of a realization that weight and lifestyle is a super important piece of the puzzle, but it's still a really hard thing for a doctor, for example, to help with, right? So it like you said, it's a 6-month long program, and that is hopefully enough time to help somebody change nutritional and exercise habits. But when you go in to see the doctor, they've got about 5 minutes to give you, right? So how much coaching is really going to happen there? And again, they can say, maybe you should lose some weight. Here's a pamphlet about eating better, for example. But how much is that really going to do? So I think where we want to see the world go is towards a place that clinical medicine really recognizes weight and healthy habits as a crucial part of somebody's health, right? And use that as a tool to focus a lot more on, I guess, I would call it treating the underlying cause rather than the outcomes of disease. So I guess the other thing I would say is it's, I guess, inevitable that tech and technology will change how we engage with these things. So again, seeing a doctor for 5 minutes is not going to enable you to change your life. But if they can give you access to face-to-face but video appointment, if they can give you access to an app that really does actually help you change your habits, there's so much that we can do with technology to put those tools in the hands of the patient and give them the tools that they need to change, which that's not a pamphlet, that's not a 5-minute appointment, but you can democratize access to all of these things in large part with technology. So that's where we would hope things go.
Yeah, and one more thing I would add is making this process more enjoyable. Previously, we had to struggle. We had to cook it on our own to find some specific organic foods, which is not a very easy task. And right now, you have access to all these different programs, mostly in bigger cities, but in smaller as well. And it's much easier to do. You have just to subscribe and trust into somebody's product. And they will help you. And that is a big game changer, I think, for people to become healthy.
And I think that what technology does on top of that is, so you're a product designer about creating delightful moments, right? And I think that with this tech layer on top of habits and behaviors and what we eat, how we exercise, how we think about things, you create this additional opportunity to create delightful moments for people. And okay, yes, sticking to a certain diet or an exercise plan is really hard, but how can you create those additional moments of joy? So not just when you step on the scale and you see that the weights come off, not just when you break your 5K record or whatever it is, but to your point about doing a tiny habit and building from there, how can you do the same thing as somebody goes through that health journey and reward them continuously so that engaging in the right behaviors continues to be this exciting thing? I think technology is not the answer to all of this, but it does create these additional moments that somebody can be incentivized on a really small scale to engage in that behavior. And so again, like, I think design is such, I guess, product design and the way that we build these products, like, determines whether we're successful at that, but holds a lot of opportunity to make it a much more enjoyable experience for somebody.
So what was your biggest challenge while building Habitual?
It's a good question. I guess I'll take the founder perspective and being a first-time founder. I think probably the biggest challenge, but also the most fun part of it, is that you have to do literally everything in the beginning. And that, I would say, is what gets me up every day and excited about work, because I never know what's going to come my direction. But it also means that you have to wear so many different hats. You have to be fundraising. You have to be dealing with angry customers. You have to take out the trash. You have to find a new office. You have to hire new people. And it's such a juggling act. And I think that's something that you really just, you don't ever experience that until you start a business. No matter how varied your roles are within a certain job, it's just to the next level. And then on top of having all these hats to wear, you're just so much more personally invested in it. So you want to wear all those hats. So I think that's, you can expect that to be what will happen when you start a company. But I guess I didn't really fully understand how many different things I would always have to be doing. I think my co-founder sent me some podcast or something about problems and how we often end up focusing on the problems and how can I get rid of this problem? But actually, life would be super boring if we didn't have problems, right? So it's not about fixing or solving or being in a place of no problems. Like, actually, that's what keeps us going and motivated. But how do you not let those problems, going back to what we've just been talking about, how do you not let them spin you out of control and just take one at a time and really enjoy the process of coming up with solutions? Because that's really what it's all about at the end of the day.
That's so true. And I have a few questions, fast fire questions. So I will be asking and you can just answer and I won't be commenting. The first question is, what is the next big thing in healthcare?
Oof, gosh, what is the next big thing? There are just so many. I think the thing I would say for, I guess, this year is, I would say 2020 was the year of telemedicine and when it became mainstream. If you look at the numbers, it was like a tiny fraction to the majority of appointments. I think this year we'll see that go to the next level. So if you look at the types of appointments that happened mostly last year were non-acute one-off things. I think we'll see that go to the next level and to really tie in with all of the data that we're now collecting on patients. So whatever that looks like, that could be many different things, but take telemedicine from just a one-on-one call over video and build on top of that. And you'll see like Babylon is doing things. They're adding on new features, good or bad. I think they're testing lots of things and they're just one example of a telemedicine provider. But because that is now the platform that everybody's used to using, taking that to the next level.
What are you most skeptical about in healthcare?
So many things. Gosh, most skeptical. I think generally I would say pharmaceuticals. I know that's like a really broad answer, but if you look at the incentives for pharmaceutical companies, they're often so misaligned with what's in the best interest of patients. That is not the case in many, many cases, but I think that pharmaceuticals to me are just the prime example of treating a symptom rather than treating an underlying cause. And I think that the more money we pour into coming up with drugs for things that have other treatments that we're just too lazy or don't want to spend the effort on, the worse outcomes you'll get for patients because you'll never treat what's actually causing the problem.
And if you could write anything on a billboard, what would it be?
I guess I would say our tagline, which is health is a habit. And like I was talking about before, we talk about habits really holistically. And at the end of the day, it's true, right? Everything you do rolls up to be what your health is in the long term. And that is what you eat. That is how you exercise. It's how much you sleep. It's your mental health. So I think really if I could get a message out there, it's to encourage everybody to think more holistically about their habits and how all of those build to create the picture of health that they have.
Since we are talking about mental health as well, the last question would be three things you do to support your mental health at work or just in life.
So we actually do something as a company, which is that every day, all of our employees get up to an hour to do something to make themselves happier or healthier. And we say in the morning what we're going to do, and then we track whether we've done it or not. And it's not designed to be like a, you must do something healthy today, but it's really just designed to give people the space and the time to be able to look after themselves, which I think, especially in pandemic times and in lockdown, has been so crucial. So I would say for me personally, what I do, I really love sleep. So I always do what I can to prioritize getting enough sleep. I don't know if you've read the book, Why We Sleep, but I wouldn't say I've ever been a bad sleeper, but it just really made me realize how important it is to our health overall. Mm-hmm. So that would be one. The second is exercise. So in any form, even if it's 10, 15 minutes a day, just something to move and breathe. And then the third thing I would say is connecting with friends and family. So obviously it's much harder in these pandemic times, but really just making sure to stay close. And there's so much to say that people that have deeper connections with others are healthier in so many ways. It's not just about feeling better mentally, this nebulous thing. It has a big role to play in health. So really staying close to the people that matter.
Thank you so much.